Hey folks, if you haven't tried Audible yet, what are you waiting on? You've heard me talk about it for a while now. Audible offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre, from bestsellers to mysteries and thrillers, true crime and more. Audible is the home of storytelling. You'll discover thousands of podcasts from popular favorites to exclusive new series. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. But members also get full access to a growing selection of included audiobooks, Audible originals, and podcasts, and you can download or stream those included titles all you want. And the Audible app is great. Makes it very easy to listen anytime, anywhere, whether you're traveling, working out, walking the dog, or just doing your chores. Right now, I'm listening to a thriller titled Then She Was Gone by Lisa Jewell. It's absolutely amazing. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/TCAT or text TCAT to 500-500. That's audible.com/TCATT or text TCAT to 500-500. Everyone, and welcome to episode 98 of the True Crime All the Time podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, what is going on?
What's happening, man?
Not much, except I spilled water all over the freaking desk, barely missed my laptop.
Yeah, you did.
We almost had a catastrophe.
And I wanted to see sparks fly in the air.
What if it shut the whole system down? All of our research, everything.
That would be bad. We'd still get through it.
Well, I think if nothing else, you could just make it up as you go. Facts be damned.
Exactly. We would just say some of the information may or may not be correct.
And this is what we think happened.
And this is what we think how it would have went down if we were there.
All right. Let's give our Patreon shout outs first. We had Christy. Aaron Keller jumped out to our highest level.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Dynasty Chriselle Lockett.
Ooh, Dynasty.
Dana Tracy.
Hey, Dana.
Stacy Taylor.
Thank you, Stacy.
Lauren. Kelly Trainer. Denise Callahan jumped out at her highest level.
Callahan parts.
Yeah, Callahan breaks.
Yeah.
Terry Toganen.
Toganen?
I'm not sure about that. I'm going with that, though.
How about we go TT?
TT. Heather Brabble.
Hey, Heather Brabola.
Megan Valier. Or Valier, if you want to be fancy.
Valier.
She jumped out at our highest level.
Awesome. Thank you.
Betty Winter.
Betty Winter.
Tamara Myers-White jumped out at our highest level.
That's a fancy name.
It is fancy.
Yeah.
Kyle Gifford.
Hey, Kyle.
Amber Powell.
We know Amber. Thanks, Amber.
Colette Marsh.
Hey, Colette. Thank you.
Megan Capps. Tim Hayward.
Hey, Tim.
Jess Plant. James Cann.
Because he knows how to do it.
Because he can do it. Gretchen Hereford.
Because she's always there for you.
Jumped out at her highest level.
Yeah.
Lisa Sangalang.
Hey, Sangalang.
Nicole Beretta.
That's cool.
Shane McCartney.
Sorry, Irish.
Related to Paul. Kate Alexander jumped out at her highest level.
Really? Thank you, Kate.
As did Donna Mertz. She jumped out at her highest level,
awesome.
Too.
Thank you, Donna.
Nicole Emmanuel.
Emmanuel.
Meredith Burrell.
Yeah, thank you.
Dana Tapper.
Awesome.
Katie Sedlasic jumped out at our highest level.
Sedlasky.
Jessica Robson.
Hey, thank you.
And Timothy McCouch.
Wow, thanks, Timothy.
So a lot of great support. We really appreciate that new support.
I like me couch, too.
I love my couch.
Yeah.
For sure. And we appreciate all the people that continue to support us on Patreon month after month. So speaking of that, Gibbs, let's go back into the vault. And this week, we selected Chris Ryan.
Hey, Chris.
Longtime supporter of the show, so big shout out. We appreciate that. And we had some PayPal support as well. We had Haley Bilka.
Bilka.
And Lena Fogelstrom.
Oh, Fogelstrom. I like that.
You like that?
So thank you both very much.
Very strong.
Very strong.
All right, Gibbs, we have got a packed episode.
It's really packed.
Jam-packed. So we've got to get going.
Dive in.
Let's talk about Unsolved.
Okay.
We are talking about the Monster of Florence on True Crime All Time Unsolved. It's going to be a great episode.
It is.
It is going to be a two-parter.
It is.
Because there's a lot of information.
And it's in Italy.
And it's in Italy. So our Florence foodie group is going to eat that one up.
Oh, yes. Florence foodies shall be the very happy.
And there's going to be a lot of bad Chef Boyardee.
By you, yes. I'll try to correct you as we move along through the processor.
Now, I also want to tell people about Criminology. Season 4 is out right now.
Man, already.
Just started. And what we're doing this season is a series of cases, all solved in 2018, but all solved using DNA and forensic genealogy, the type of things that they used to solve the East Area Rapist case. And so there's going to be some really good episodes. So check that out. And don't forget, the new TCAT magnets are in the store right now.
They're cool.
They're very cool.
Yeah.
They fit into an envelope, so shipping is included in the price. So make sure you check those out.
I carry one in my pocket at all times.
You should.
Yeah.
To make sure you don't lose your keys.
No, that's not why I use it, but I mean, yeah. Okay.
Just to give your keys an anchor.
Yeah.
All right, Gibbs, I'm going to do something different. I'm going to start out by playing a couple clips. We haven't done that in a long time, but I feel like it makes sense in this case.
Let's dive in.
How did this come to be, man? Does the word monster come to mind? At one point, I could control it. It's beyond my control at the moment. I'm a homicidal maniac. I don't mean to be.
So you're hearing Sean Vincent Gillis talk. And he says, Gibbs, does the word monster come to mind? He's talking about himself.
Yeah.
Then he calls himself a homicidal maniac. And this guy was. He was extremely brutal. You know, a serial killer that operated for almost a decade in and around Baton Rouge, Louisiana. So we're down in Louisiana.
Louisiana.
Again.
Yeah.
He confessed to murdering 8 women during this time, but he was not alone. And we'll talk about this as the episode progresses, but Baton Rouge had multiple serial killers, including Derek Todd Lee, operating during this time. And the sheer number of different killers made it very difficult for authorities. But Gillis stalked, tracked, murdered, mutilated, dismembered his victims. He committed necrophilia, and he even consumed parts of some of his victims. So Wow. He runs the gamut.
He did it all.
I mean, we're talking about necrophilia, cannibalism. This guy was something else. And I can't believe, Gibbs, that he's not more well-known than he is. Right? You and I have talked about that. What makes somebody truly infamous? And I'm shocked that this guy is not more infamous than he is.
No, he's really not. But you would have, you after you hear this,
you would think
you would have thought he would have.
Yeah,
been.
You would have thought he would be. So obviously I'm painting the picture here that this is a bad guy, and he is. This is a guy that a prosecutor in his trial would call a true serial killer. For the majority of his murders, he targeted sex workers, drug addicts, anyone who, in his mind, would not be missed by society. And he didn't target women of just one race. He murdered both Caucasian and African-American women. So that, again, you know, couple that with the number of serial killers operating in this space and this time, all of that made it extremely hard for investigators. Gillis was a sexual deviant. And his murders would show the evidence of that. So let's get into his childhood, Gibbs. You and I love to start there. Sean Vincent Gillis was born June 24, 1962 in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to Norman and Yvonne Gillis. His father, Norman, left the family when Sean was only a year old. He was in and out of mental institutions for most of his life, suffered from alcoholism. This is all his father, Norman. Yeah. And he didn't contact the family again until Sean was 17. So he was gone for essentially his entire upbringing. This left his mother, Yvonne, to raise Sean on her own, and she doted on him and did what seems to me, Gibbs, to be a pretty good job of raising him as a single parent. She took him to visit his father's parents on a regular basis just so that he could develop a good relationship with them. So this is not a serial killer that we're going to be talking about who had an unbelievably bad childhood. Yeah, he did grow up without his father, but he wasn't beaten. He didn't have some of the same childhood traumas that we talk about in a lot of these killers. In 1971, Sean's about 9 years old. Yvonne was able to move them into a home in a nicer neighborhood in Baton Rouge. The problem is what Yvonne thought about her son, Sean, and what others thought in the neighborhood about him, they were completely different. She either didn't see the same things that they saw because he wasn't presenting, or she just had blinders on. And that can happen, right?
Yeah, sure.
That happens to parents. They don't see what other people see sometimes. But she thought he hung the moon. She thought he was a very sweet kid. But other people that knew him as a boy, they said he was very strange. And to the point, Gibbs, that other kids in the neighborhood, they stayed away from him as much as they could. Now, he did have a couple of close friends that he hung out with. So again, we're not talking about a kid or a guy that's a complete loner, as we do in a lot of the cases that we profile. Gillis would later tell police that when he was around 12 years old, he tried to kill his female cousin. And the reason that he told police that he did this was because he wanted to feel her breasts. So that's pretty extreme. Number one, you shouldn't be trying to feel your cousin's breasts. Let's just put that out there.
Yeah, that's not good.
But the thought in his head is, I'm going to murder her so that I can do it. That's not good.
That's not good at all. Not at all.
Sean didn't go to public school. His mother was adamant about sending him to Catholic school. And she worked hard. She was a single mother. She worked hard to take care of Sean and get the money together to send him. He was an average student. But again, his mother had this completely different view of Sean. She thought he was brilliant. You know, he was the smartest kid in school. And I don't know how you equate that with the report card that comes in the mail that you're looking at, but this is what she thought.
Right.
When Sean was 17, his paternal grandfather passed away. And this is what brought his father, Norman, back into his life. And the two would begin to develop a relationship. That would be tough. 16 years. And all of a sudden you're like, hey, Dad, let's hang out. So Gillis graduated from high school. He attended community college for a while. He drifted through numerous convenience store jobs. That's basically, for most of his life, that's what he would be, is a clerk at various convenience stores. But he also developed a penchant for pornography. In the early 90s, Sean's mother moved to Georgia for a job. She wanted Sean to go with her, but he didn't want to go. So he stayed living in her house in Baton Rouge. She even agreed to continue paying the mortgage on the house. On top of that, she gave him extra money. The house was described as a small one-story house with pink trim in a neighborhood that was made up of a combination of working class people and students from Louisiana State University. So they lived pretty close to LSU, to the campus. But then you get into what people thought about Sean Gillis around the neighborhood, right? He's older now, but the thoughts about him really haven't changed from the time that he was a boy. You know, people thought he was strange. Even as he got into adulthood, Neighbors said, Gibbs, that he would cuss at people as they drove by in their cars. He would bang on people's doors late at night. He would make outrageous claims like he invented the question mark.
Really?
Sometimes he would accuse chestnuts of being lazy.
Just because they're laying there?
You know.
No.
That's from Austin Powers.
Oh.
I thought for sure you'd get that one.
No, I didn't get that one.
No, he didn't do those last two things. But he was arrested by police for just one night being out in front of his house, banging on garbage cans. And when the arresting officer asked him why the hell he was banging on garbage cans, he answered, because I don't have a girl.
Okay.
That was his reasoning. I think this is why he was so upset, because he didn't have female companionship. He was also caught peeping in the window of a young female neighbor. And I think this also is something that differentiates Sean Gillis from a lot of the other killers that we talk about. He didn't have really like a 20-year rap sheet. He had very minor offenses. I think he was arrested once for criminal trespassing. He maybe had some traffic violations, but that was really about it. He did not have a long criminal history. But his mother's gone in Georgia. He has this house to himself. She's giving him extra money. And his obsession with pornography deepens as we get into the 1990s. And this would develop into a very serious computer pornography addiction. And it would have major ramifications later in life. It was said that, you know, he would skip work days just to sit at home on his computer looking at porn. And this had to be, Gibbs, back in the AOL days.
Imagine
is dial-up for sure. You know, it would take hours just to get one picture to come up. That's what I've been told. Now, I don't have firsthand knowledge of that, but, you know, back in the 90s.
I think you kind of do.
Back in the 90s, you know, it's much different than today with the dial-up.
You're much happier today.
Am I? Not because of that, but yeah.
Okay.
So Gillis began a relationship with a woman named Terry Lemoyne in 1994. A friend introduced the two, and they quickly, you know, they hit it off. They bonded over their shared hobby of collecting old rock albums. Apparently, they both loved Star Trek. Maybe they went to some of the Trekkie conventions. I don't know. Maybe they were there with you, Gibbs, wearing your full Spock outfit.
Well, something about pointy ears, man.
I've seen you in it. Don't deny that you have a Spock outfit and that you go to the Star Trek conventions.
At least I didn't dress as a Klingon.
That's true. But I guess I've seen relationships, Gibbs, that are built on less than that. At least they had some shared interests.
It's true. Like your furries.
That's a shared interest.
Yeah. Very special.
But both Gillis and Lemoyne were loners. And I think this is something that also drew them together. Gillis began murdering in 1994, which I really find strange. Because to me, it seemed as though in the past, he was, like I said, he was very upset about the fact that he didn't have a love in his life. He didn't have a woman in his life. Well, now all of a sudden he finally gets one. You know, he has a girlfriend, Terry, and now he's going to start murdering. I found that very odd. His first victim was 81-year-old Ann Bryan. 81 years old.
That's, I can't even imagine.
And we're going to see it as we go through the victims, right? I talked about the fact that he didn't have a type, right? Whether it was skin color, nope, didn't matter to him. Age range doesn't matter either. I mean, it's going to span, you know, the gamut. His first victim is 81 years old. Ann Bryan lived in a Baton Rouge assisted living facility called St. James Place, straight out of Monopoly.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's one of the purple ones.
No, it's orange.
Is it orange?
St. James Place? Yeah, it's orange.
That's one of the three properties.
One of the three?
No, it's a group of three. Some of them are groups of three, some are groups of two.
Almost all of them are groups of three.
Except for Park Place.
The blue ones.
Those are just the two, right?
And then the right around the corner, the little light whatever they are, light purple or light blue.
Those are two.
Those are the only ones that are two.
Well, that's a 20% of the board.
That's not.
10% of the board.
That's one of those two things. Oh, it's one of those triples.
One of those trifectas.
But this St. James place where she lived, it was right across the street from the convenience store where Gillis worked. And it was just blocks from where he lived. So Gillis entered her residence early on the morning of March 20th with the intent to rape 81-year-old Ann Bryant. But things went south very quickly because as he started to touch her, she began screaming. And he freaked out, he panicked, and slit her throat to stop her from screaming.
That's just wrong. Well, the whole thing's wrong.
Sure.
Yeah. But, I mean, my gosh. Went in there thinking it's sexual assault and ends up murder? It's all wrong.
It's all wrong, sure.
But
sexual assault of an 81-year-old woman, and then he slits her throat. But that wasn't it. You know, after he did that, he stabbed her, he slashed her upwards of maybe 50 times before leaving her body there at the crime scene. And there's no doubt, an extremely vicious attack. This woman, Gibbs, was almost both decapitated and disemboweled. This is how brutal this thing was.
This nasty man. I mean, seriously.
And it was said that he focused much of the knife attack on her breasts and genitals. So that's not random. That is going back to, you know, what I said, this guy's a sexual deviant. You don't just happen to be stabbing and hit the breasts and genitals, right? That just doesn't happen. You were doing that on purpose for a specific reason. Most cases, it's some type of sexual gratification.
Yeah.
So he's committed his first murder. He and Terry Lemoyne moved in together in 1995. And it didn't take long for Terry to start having concerns with his behavior. Number one, he drank a lot. And she was worried about his obsession with pornography.
So he had a couple addictions.
He did.
You know,
at least a couple.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just pornography, right? It wasn't just pictures of naked women. This was pornography centered around rape, centered around death.
Yeah. Violent pornography.
Very, very violent.
Yeah.
And she saw this. He actually showed her pictures and she was disgusted by them, but probably didn't think anything more of it, then I don't like that. I'm not sure why he likes it, but whatever. But to me, that's a pretty major red flag, I would think. I mean, what about you, Gibbs?
That's a huge red flag for me. It'd be weird to have to see your significant other looking at that kind of stuff, thinking that's what turns them on.
Rape and death?
Yeah, it'd be really difficult, you know? It's hard enough to deal with other addictions, you know? I mean, it's alcoholism or whatever, drug addict or something like that, but to throw this on top of it.
And it can be a real addiction. Pornography.
Well, I know you did well through your program.
People can really spiral.
Yeah. I'm not afraid to use your keyboard anymore, so it's all good.
Now, another red flag to me that comes out is that apparently Sean didn't want to have sex with Terry, with some reports saying they only had it a few times during their entire relationship. That's got to be some type of flag. Red, magenta.
Magenta.
Higher than yellow, but if not red, just, you know, maroon, burgundy.
Just go red.
Cinnamon.
Now we're getting into...
I'm running out of colors.
Yeah.
But you also have to think how much of that is because of his addiction to pornography. He's probably getting his release that way, which is decreasing his interest in sex. Now, I don't know that for a fact, but I'm theorizing. For a few years after they moved in together, he was somehow able to tamp down his homicidal, sexually sadistic urges, but that would all change in 1999. But it's about 5 years. between his first murder and his second. Terry Lemoyne worked the night shift, and that gave Sean plenty of time to hunt for victims. And it was in January of 99, he targeted and murdered 29-year-old Catherine Hall. Catherine was a sex worker that Gillis lured into his car for oral sex. Once she was in the car...
How do you lure someone in for oral sex?
I don't know how you lure. That's not a word. I don't even know how you lure.
I mean, lure.
How do you lure?
How you lure?
Yeah.
Yeah, like your fishing lure?
Yeah.
How are you going to lure?
You said lure.
Did I say lure?
Yeah.
I was being fancy? No.
That's not fancy.
No. So how do you lure?
Maybe I'm using the wrong word because...
I thought you just like take a $20 bill and lick it and stick it to the windshield, the window, and they see it and they say, okay.
Why would you have to lick it to get it to stick?
Oh. Well, how else are you going to get the stick?
Yeah, you're right. Maybe I'm using the wrong word. It probably wasn't that hard for Gillis to get her into the car. That's what she's out there for.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what she's trying to do is to, you know, meet someone.
He just kind of pulled up and went, beep, beep.
Yeah. You're right. I probably used the wrong word. I mean, you said it totally jacked up. But other than that, we're all good. But once she got into the car, Gillis put a plastic zip tie around her neck and tightened it until she was dead. And this is going to be his preferred method of killing. Strangulation by zip tie.
Not a bad method.
Not at all. But when I think about it, it gives me the shivers.
Yeah, because you can buy the industrial zip ties, right? A little wider, a little thicker, longer. You can already have it ready. So all you have to do is slip it over the head, and you just got to give it one hard yank, and there's no backing off of it.
That's why it's so scary.
Yeah. Once it's on and you pull hard enough, even if they get away, they're going to have a bitch of a time.
You could die just running away.
Yeah.
If it was tight enough.
Yeah. Kind of reminds me of that movie, I don't know, here we go, but with Brad Pitt at the very end, he's walking down the street and somebody comes up like jogging behind him and puts this a machine zip tie over his head, and it has a little motor. It keeps cranking, and it's closing down on his throat, and there's nothing you can do. You can't stop it. It has a little motor in it.
So you're going to pick an actor who's made 8,000 movies and say in this one movie.
Yeah, he plays like a American drug transporter type of guy, middleman.
I have no idea.
You don't even know what it's called?
Mm-mm.
It's got Cameron Diaz in it as the drug woman.
People are screaming at home saying the name of it, but I don't know what it is.
What's the Spanish guy? He was in No Man for Old Country.
Javier Bardem?
Yes. Javier was in it.
I don't know what it is.
And Michael
Fassbender.
He was the main character.
So you know 8,000 people that are in it, but have no clue what the movie is called.
I don't remember the name of the movie.
But I don't know.
At the end, Brad Pitt gets this like fancy mechanical zip tie around his neck. And all he does is the guy comes up behind it, slips it over and hits the button, and it automatically starts cranking.
Well, now you've spoiled it. Now there's no way for me to watch it.
There's many endings to the movie. Okay. This is just one of the things that happens.
But it is so scary to think about.
Yeah.
Because you think, I mean, yeah, industrial, but even just take a regular old zip tie. You know how hard those things are to break?
I can break them.
I'm saying a normal person.
Oh.
A person without special abilities.
Do you have any? Let's try one around your neck.
No, I'm not doing that.
Well, I mean,
because I'm freaked out. Seriously.
Well, I mean, no, we're keeping clippers, bro. I mean, I'll clip it off.
No, no.
I mean, I got you.
I'm literally filled with anxiety thinking about it.
Well, because you know exactly. Because your neck. It doesn't matter. You know, I mean, he's going to pull as hard as he can, and the zip tie is going to do all the work at that point.
And once he gets it to a certain point, there, like you said, there's no return.
No, it's done.
Well, we're going to be talking about zip ties quite a bit. Gillis stabbed Catherine 16 times prior to her death while she was being strangled with this zip tie, and then stabbed her many more times after she was dead. He removed her clothing and mutilated her body. And he dumped her body near a dead-end sign.
And this is something that prosecutors later on are going to theorize that was a game, was part of a game to him. Like it meant something, right? To pick a dead-end sign to leave this body. The hunter found it the very next day, but police would find a pubic hair in Catherine's mouth that would prove invaluable years later. All right, Gibbs, let's take a quick break and talk about Simply Safe. You know what a huge fan I am of Simply Safe, and I know you are too. Simply Safe is ready for anything that gets thrown at it. If a storm takes out your power, Simply Safe is ready. Someone cuts your phone line, they're ready. And they probably go way over the top. You know, maybe you don't need to be ready for every worst case scenario, but I say you do. And that's what makes Simply Safe home security systems so great. It's always ready. And it doesn't cost an arm and a leg. They charge you a fair amount. 24/7 professional security monitoring is just $14.99 a month. There's no contracts and no hidden fees. I recommend Simply Safe to everyone I know. I've been using it for years, way before they became a sponsor of True Crime All the Time. So go to simplysafe.com/TCAT today. That's simplysafe.com/TCAT. To protect your home and family today. SimplySafe.com/TCAT.
You know, my wife and I, we both use Rakuten when we shop online to help save money. My wife uses it more than I do because, well, let's face it, she shops more than I do. Rakuten is the most rewarding way to shop and save because members earn cash back on everything that they buy. Rakuten is a shopping platform that partners with over 3,500 stores across every category. You're already shopping at your favorite stores. Why not save while doing it? It really is a no-brainer. I use it for all my techie stuff at stores like Best Buy. My wife uses it at stores like Sephora and Macy. Best of all, membership is free and it's easy to sign up. It's very easy to use. Cashback rates change daily. So start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app to start saving today. Your cash back really adds up. In May of 1999, so we're about, 4 months later, Gillis murdered 52-year-old Hardy Schmidt. Schmidt was not a sex worker. She wasn't, into drugs. And I only point it out because besides the very first victim, this is unusual for him in how he selects his victims. Schmidt was married with three children. She lived an affluent, comfortable life. She was an avid runner, and Gillis targeted her one day when he saw her out running. I even read, Gibbs, that she had run the Boston Marathon.
Really?
Yeah, so she was a pretty big-time runner. If I even think about running a marathon, I get the sweats.
Just saying the words marathon, you're sweating now.
Yeah. So he targeted her on this one day he saw her running, but then he began stalking her for weeks. And it was at the end of the month, May 30th, weeks later, she's out for a run, and there's no way that she could have known that a serial killer was stalking her. Again, talk about scary. These are scary things. So Gillis is driving in his car, and he decides that he's going to run Hardy Schmidt down. He hit her with his car and knocked her into a ditch. So after hitting her with the car, he got out, very easily overpowered her. She'd just been hit by a car.
Yeah.
Tied one of his zip ties around her neck and strangled her. He put her into the trunk of his car, drove to an isolated area where he removed her clothing and raped her. He put her dead body back in the trunk, and apparently he left it there overnight. And there were even reports that he was driving his girlfriend Terry around in the car with the dead body in the trunk, and she made some comments about a smell.
Smells in here.
And he tried to cover it up by saying, I think he'd hit an animal or something like that.
Well, I hit a skunk this morning, baby.
But the very next day, he dumped Schmidt's body into a bayou in St. James Parish, and it was discovered a day after that. Gillis murdered his fourth victim, 36-year-old Joyce Williams, on November 12, 1999. He picked up Williams, who was a sex worker, and again, killed her by tightening a zip tie around her neck.
This is every murder.
It's
with the zip tie.
Well, it's because it's working.
It was very effective for him.
Don't go changing if it's working. I hate to say that. You know what I'm saying, though.
Well, no, I get what you're saying. A killer is not going to change up, or they probably are not going to change up what works for them.
Right.
Actually, it's when they do change things up a lot of times that they get caught.
Right, exactly.
After he murdered Williams, he brought her body back to the house that he shared with Lemoyne. This is the first time that he had brought one of his victims back to his house. And then he proceeded, Gibbs, to cut off parts of her body, cut off her nipples, which he ate.
Okay.
So he is progressing very quickly, upping his viciousness, his sadisticness, whatever you want to call it. Now he's into mutilation. Now he's into cannibalism.
Raw cannibalism.
He's already been into necrophilia.
Yeah. Well, once you go that step, there's probably not much, you know, you're not turning around.
No.
You're probably moving forward with whatever else is on the chart.
You're not going straight, you know, after that. You're looking for what else is going to heighten this sexual thing that I'm looking for.
Yeah.
I don't know where you go from there.
Well,
but he's gonna go.
He's going.
He mutilated other parts of her body. He cut off flesh. He ate that as well. Eventually, he dumped her body in Iberville, where Hunter stumbled upon her severed leg bone. This was January 22nd, 2000, on the bank of the Mississippi. So it was about 2 months later that they found her leg bone. The hunters called police. Police found the rest of her body about 700 feet away from where the leg bone was.
Not too far away.
No, not too far away, but, you know, imagine yourself as a hunter. You're relaxed. You're walking through the woods. All of a sudden, you see a leg bone.
Yeah. Freak you out.
In January of 2000, Gillis claimed his fifth victim. This time, it was 52-year-old Lillian Robinson. Lillian was a sex worker. Gillis picked her up, strangled her with the zip tie, and took her back to his house. But apparently, this time, he didn't have the time he needed to do with her body what he had done to his previous victim. Because his girlfriend, Terry, was scheduled to get off work soon. He had just enough time, in his words, to play with her dead body. And he would admit later that he put his penis in her mouth. He committed sexual acts with her dead body. Gillis took the body, dumped it in a swampy basin, and Lillian's body was discovered a few months later in March. In October 2000, he murdered her sixth victim. This was 38-year-old Marilyn Nevels. Again, she was a sex worker who he got into his car with the premise that they were going to have sex or some type of sexual act. He strangled her with a zip tie, dumped her body by the Mississippi River in Baton Rouge, just a few miles from his house. Her body was found later that month on Halloween. No one ever reported Marilyn Nevels missing.
That's sad.
It is sad.
It really is.
And I'm not just talking about within a few days. No one would ever know what happened to her for 4 years until Sean Gillis ultimately confessed to her murder. 4 years, Gibbs, went by.
But no one missed her.
No one missed her. No one reported her missing. But again, this goes back to Sean Gillis. For the majority of his victims, and he said this, looked for people that he felt would not be missed. Those were his words. After the murder of Marilyn Nevels, Gillis took a 3-year break from killing. That's a pretty long time.
That is a long time.
For a serial killer. Especially one with the type of, you know, sadistic sexual needs that this guy seems to have. Now, we haven't profiled Derek Todd Lee yet, but I know we will. He's been on our list, Gibbs, for a very long time.
And his name's come up in a few of the unsolved ones we've done.
It has. Yeah, we've talked about him before, but we haven't done a full episode on him. He was operating during much of the same time that Gillis was. And it's been reported that Sean Gillis was a fan of his work. I mean, he went as far as to save newspaper articles on the murders committed by Lee on his computer. So he was studying what Lee was doing. And it would come out later that he was determined not to be outdone by Derek Todd Lee. So it's almost like he was keeping score and he wasn't going to lose.
So all you need is a handful of serial killers in the same area at the same time trying to
outdo each other.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not a good recipe. There's multiple serial killers operating. There are a lot of women in the area over this time frame that turn up dead. So they create a task force. And eventually they do arrest Derek Todd Lee in May of 2003. And it helped calm the community. You know, because I think, especially in the beginning, they thought he had killed a lot of these women, which he did kill a lot of women.
Yeah.
But what the community couldn't know was that, again, he was just one of several serial killers on the loose at that time. And once authorities figured out that Lee didn't commit all of the murders, they knew they still had at least one serial killer out there. And one of those was Sean Gillis, and he would strike two more times before he was caught. Gillis murdered 45-year-old Johnny Mae Williams in October 2003. She was a mother of three that turned to sex work in order to provide for her family. But what's strange about this one, Gibbs, is that Gillis had known Williams for years, sometimes paid her to clean his house.
Yeah, so he has a knowledge about her.
He's got a link to her.
Yeah.
That's normally not something that is very smart when it comes to serial killers picking out their victims. He picked Williams up in his car one night, drove to a secluded location, and proceeded to beat, rape, and strangle her. Again, killed her with a zip tie by strangulation. But after she was dead, he mutilated her corpse with a knife, and he cut off her hands. Then he took her body and posed it in various positions and took a bunch of photographs.
It's crazy.
Isn't it?
Yeah. She goes over there, helps him out, cleans his house for money.
Right. He's paying her.
Yeah.
But it was talked about in a lot of the articles that they were friendly towards each other. You know, maybe they smoked weed together from time to time.
Sure.
Or whatever. They knew each other. Now, the eighth and final victim of Sean Gillis was a woman named Donna Bennett Johnston. Johnston was a 43-year-old divorced mother of five. So it's February 26, 2004. Sean Gillis is driving around in his car. He's searching for a victim when he sees Donna Johnston on a street corner. She was intoxicated and she got inside the car. The two of them discussed prices for different sexual acts, but it wouldn't go any further than that. His intent was not sex. It was murder. He strangled Donna with a zip tie. He drove to a secluded area, removed all of her clothing. He slashed her body with a knife and used it to cut off one of her nipples. Then he took the knife, Gibbs, and he cut out a tattoo that was on her right thigh.
Just wanted to keep that, huh?
He literally cut out
the tattoo.
The tattoo. But then goes a step further and removes her left arm at the elbow.
What a weird thing to do. Well, all of it's weird.
But it gets weirder, right? Because it's reported that he took the arm home with him and he used it later to masturbate with the arm.
So he just wanted to have her hand, and that's really weird.
But we know serial killers take trophies. We know they like to relive what they've done. And you know, this is what he was doing by doing this. He was reliving it all.
Yeah, absolutely what he was doing. We've seen it before.
Yeah. He took other souvenirs. He took a blanket, a belt, an earring that belonged to Donna. Now, police would find DNA under Johnston's fingernails on her right hand, because that's the only one she had left. He cut the left one off. And this DNA, they're later going to be able to match to Sean Gillis. But the other thing they found at the scene was probably just as important. They found some tire tracks where Donna's body was found, which was in a drainage canal about a mile south of the LSU campus. Not far from LSU at all. And these tire tracks, they're going to be crucial in identifying who killed Donna Johnston. So this task force I talked about is on the case. They are starting to close in on Gillis. I mean, number one, they've got some really good evidence now. They've got the tire tracks. They've got some hair that was collected from two of the victims, which they were able to get DNA from. They were able to get DNA from under Donna's fingernails. So not only are they going to identify a killer, they're also linking these murders together, right? Because the DNA is all going to point to the same person. So they test all this DNA, but unfortunately, it doesn't match anyone in the system. So right now, it's really of no use to them until they find out who it matches to, or a suspect that they're going to try to match it up to.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Right now, they've just got DNA, but nobody to match it with. But that's where the tire tracks come in. They were determined to be tires made by Goodyear, and they were not huge sellers. They were only made for a few years, and this was a big break, right? If it was a tire that was made for 10 years and it was all around the country,
the top seller,
it'd be much harder. This was not a big seller, so authorities worked with Goodyear to get a list of those specific tires that had been sold in the Baton Rouge area. And they narrowed it down. They got the list. They started narrowing it down of people that had purchased those tires. They got it down to 90. Sean Gillis was number 26 on that list.
Out of 90.
So they start contacting people on the list, trying to get a DNA sample. And they do interview Sean Gillis. And of course, he denies murdering anyone.
Do you know why we're talking? We're talking because you had some tire tracks that possibly came from my car there.
And from those tracks, it appears she was unloaded from that vehicle and thrown into that canal.
She was not unloaded from my vehicle.
So he's not giving it up right at that point. But he did make a bunch of statements to police that were very suspicious. He talked about reasons why he might have been in the area where they found her body and other strange things like that. So they're very suspicious of him, but they don't have enough to hold him. So they had to let him go. But they were worried, right? They really thought this was the guy. And they thought, okay, we're going to let this guy go and he's going to do something else. But then the DNA evidence came back and it was a positive match to Sean Gillis. So now police are certain. They know they have their man. Sean Gillis was arrested in the early morning hours of April 29th, 2004. There's a SWAT team that they used to raid his house. And he pretty much gave up without incident. I don't know what the hell you're going to do up against a SWAT team, but...
Yeah, exactly.
And he was in bed with Terry when they busted in.
So he was taken in by surprise a little bit.
Yeah, he was still probably, they were asleep.
Could have been like you, not a morning person.
That's true. I am not a morning person. Now, Terry Lemoyne would say that she was shocked, obviously, that a SWAT team was in their house. But she has said that Sean simply turned to her and said, "I'm sorry, honey bunny."
Just like Pulp Fiction.
That's exactly what I thought of. "I'm sorry, honey bunny." And then an officer said to her, "Hey, didn't you know you were living with a serial killer?" So she had to be floored. You talk about a bad morning, a bad way to wake up.
Oh, terrible, man. Have someone bust through your door?
Well, not only that, but then tell you that the man that you've been living with is this unbelievable sadistic serial killer. So Gillis was booked on 3 counts of first-degree murder and 3 counts of ritualistic acts in the deaths of Catherine Hall, Johnny Mae Williams, and Donna Bennett Johnson. And he would confess to killing these 3 women. But he wouldn't stop there. You know, after he was captured, he started talking to police. And this was against his attorney's vehement advice, Gibbs, to not talk to police.
Ever.
His attorney is telling him, do not talk to police. His attorney's been quoted as saying, he insisted on confessing and said he did not want me in the room while he was talking to the cops. I told him he was crazy. And apparently Gillis said back to him, I don't know if I'm crazy or not, but this is what I want to do. His attorney would go on to say that Gillis was goofy and odd, but that he was intelligent and articulate. But he also said, Gibbs, that he had serious doubts about whether Gillis was wrapped real tight. Those were his exact words.
Just wrapped up tight.
He's not sure he's wrapped real tight.
Oh, not wrapped real tight.
Yeah, that's how he put it.
True Crime All the Time is sponsored by BetterHelp. I want to ask everybody one question. How is your social battery right now? Does it have a ton of energy or are you drained? And why is it at that level? You know, it can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin. What's the right amount of socializing for you and how do you recharge? You know, maybe you're the type of person who thrives around people or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. I think therapy is a very powerful tool for learning positive coping skills and helping to empower you to be the best version of yourself. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. No more hopping in the car, driving, and sitting in a waiting room. You can do your entire session from the comfort of your own home. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/TCAT today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/TCATT.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
So as Gillis is talking with police, he detailed out how he plotted the murders and how he tried to play games with police.
Tell me an approximate number. Five, six, seven.
I honestly don't count. I don't count coup. I don't.
So you hear Gillis. He takes a huge swig of coffee to start out with. And he says, 4, 5, 6, 7. I don't count them. It's just like so off the cuff.
Yeah.
I'm just going to tick them off with my fingers. This is how many women I've murdered. So police get a warrant. They search his house and they find a ton of evidence. They found a number of pictures on his computer of some of his victims. There were pictures of Donna Johnston's mutilated body, as well as pictures of her dead body in his trunk. So again, he's trying to, that's a souvenir, right? He's taking pictures so that he can relive that moment. They found pictures of Johnny Mae Williams' dead body. And they also found a very large number of sharp cutting instruments, saws, knives, all kinds of stuff like that. And on top of that, they found the clippings on Derek Todd Lee. And they found the very violent pornography on his computer. So, you know, they pretty much got this guy. Right? DNA. DNA matches. He's got pictures of these dead women. So the very next day, he confessed to killing 81-year-old Ann Bryan back in 1994, which we talked about. That was his first murder. and he admitted to stalking and killing 52-year-old Hardy Schmidt in 1999. And Gibbs, you know we've profiled some cases in the past where killers confessed to murders that they didn't do, right? They might have killed three, and the next thing you know, it's 10.
They're trying to up it.
Right, yep. They're trying to up it. They're trying to confess to things that they didn't do. It's something that the authorities have to be very careful with. But apparently, you know, Gillis had all of the details, you know, especially like in the murder of Ann Bryan. He gave them details that only the killer could have known. And the authorities were shocked by some of the things that he revealed. He talked about showering with some of the dead women's bodies. He spoke about painting the fingernails of Johnny Mae Williams' hand that he cut off. So he took her hand with him and painted the fingernails. I told you this is a sick puppy.
It is a sick one.
Now, Gillis had apparently confessed to his girlfriend, 46-year-old Terry Lemoyne, of the murders after he was caught, right? Not before, but after he was caught. She recounted for papers some of their conversation. I guess she asked him if he was sorry that he did this, and he said yes. Then she asked him, how could you kill these three women? This is, right, this is in the very beginning when he's only confessed to three. And he replied, it's not three, honey, it's eight. And apparently she fell to the floor crying. I mean, Gibbs, what the hell did you do in that situation? How would you react if your significant other has just told you they really did murder eight people?
Do you think she didn't know about all? I mean,
you know, I don't know. I think there were some signs. Whether she picked up on them or not, that's a different story.
Yeah.
Right? The odor in the car as they're driving. The pornography, even though it was extremely violent and, you know, focused on rape and death, and I don't know that you're going to think, you might think that's strange. That might be somebody I want to end a relationship with. You're probably not going to say, this person's out killing people.
That's true.
So
why not link it that far out?
Yeah,
it's just, I don't know. I think I'd want to like shower, vomit, not sure which order.
I was going to say, in what order?
You know?
I think there'd be some hurt.
Hurt.
Because you trust this person, you live with them.
Just the range of emotions you would have, right? I mean, like you said, trust, loyalty, all that would be out the door. All of it. Oh. Everything you believed in, for if it was 1 year, 10 years, a few months, the betrayal of that would just be crushing.
Yeah, no doubt.
And then you have to mourn for the, like,
the people that he killed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Gillis was initially charged with the murders of Donna Johnston, Catherine Hall, Joyce Williams, Hardy Schmidt, and Ann Bryan. He'd eventually be charged with two of the three remaining women he confessed to killing. So he's awaiting trial. And he wrote a series of letters in June and July after his arrest to a friend of Donna Johnston named Tammy Perpera. And these are letters that are going to be used against him later at trial, because in the letters he said he was sorry for murdering eight women. He said that he was pure evil, but he gave details about the murder of Johnston, stating she was so drunk, it only took about a minute and a half to succumb to unconsciousness and then death. Her last words were, "I can't breathe." In another letter, he wrote, "I still puzzle over the postmortem dismemberment and cutting. There must be something deep in my subconscious that needs that kind of macabre action. I really don't know what my damage is." He goes on to say in the letter, "Before 10 years ago, I never so much as imagined harming anyone." So he does express some regret there, Gibbs. I don't know how genuine it is, but I also don't get writing a letter to the friend of a woman you've murdered and essentially detailing out parts of, you know, how the murder occurred.
I don't get it either.
But I guess he's already confessed to it, so maybe he thought, what the hell, what the harm?
Yeah, I don't know if he's actually apologizing more than just...
No, I don't know that he's apologizing, but he does say that he feels bad about it. And I think he said that to Terry, too. But again, I don't know how much of that stuff is real with these killers.
Yeah, I don't know if he feels... I mean, I think he like, ah, I feel kind of bad about it.
Yeah.
Like that. Not like, you know, broken down, shaken up by it. I think he's like, you know...
Because a lot of these guys don't have the ability to really feel that.
No, it's not in their their makeup, you know? It's just not. I think he's saying just generically, I feel bad.
And a lot of times I think when they say that, what they're really saying is, I'm sorry I got caught.
Yes.
it more so than saying, I'm sorry for my actions. I'm sorry that I'm locked up.
Yeah. I mean, I think if he was in the room with the friend and you gave him a zip tie, he'd use it.
I agree with you because I think he even said something to that effect in one of the interviews with police, that if he were to walk out today, he would be looking for his next victim or something, you know, along those lines, after he already knew he was caught.
Yeah.
So he is set for multiple trials for his murders, but there was a big issue to settle, and that was around his confessions, because his defense team argued that Gillis had said at one point during the police interviews that he should probably have an attorney present. And so they argued that anything he said after that point should be inadmissible, essentially saying he asked for an attorney, you should have shut down the interview right then and there. Now, the police would counter that he just kept talking. They weren't asking him any more questions. He just kept talking. But in the end, the judge ruled that the confessions were admissible and that the jury would hear them. So he first faced trial for the murder of Joyce Williams. But just before that trial was set to begin, he pleaded guilty to second-degree murder. This is August 2007. He was given a mandatory life sentence. And apparently at the sentencing, he told the judge, I strangled Joyce Williams and she died.
Just like that?
Yeah. As we always say, just like I went out and got a pizza.
Yeah. Hit McDonald's on my way home. Here I am.
So you ate a pizza and then hit McDonald's on the way home?
Just what he's doing, man. This is what it is.
No, I was talking about you. That seems like a lot of food.
No, man, sitting. I don't eat that.
But here's the rub, Gibbs. So he pleaded guilty, but his guilty plea had a condition to it. It was made on the condition that he be allowed to appeal the decision by the judge to allow the jury to hear about his confessions that he said were made after he asked for an attorney. So I think this was his plan or his defense attorney's plan. Plead guilty. As long as they give you this condition that allows you to appeal that judge's ruling, because if he's successful in that appeal, he gets a new trial. And this time he wouldn't plead guilty, right? Because the jury would not be allowed to hear his confessions. But luckily it doesn't happen. A year later, an appellate court upheld the guilty plea, upheld the ruling by the judge. So next he's going to go on trial for the murder of Donna Bennett Johnston. And it took 6 weeks to seat a jury, which seems like a staggering amount of time to me, Gibbs. I don't know how long it normally takes to seat a jury in a big murder trial. 6 weeks seems like a long time.
Seems like a really long time.
The trial began on July 21st, 2008, and the jury found him guilty of first-degree murder 5 days later. His trial only lasted 5 days. The jury deliberated for about 3.5 hours. Again, I'm not going heavy into the trial because we already know all of the evidence they have against him. It's insurmountable. The prosecution was seeking the death penalty, but the jury was deadlocked on sentencing. And so Gillis ended up with a life sentence with no chance of parole. There was a reporter named Josh Noel that had to testify in this trial. And the reason is because he did an interview in 2004 with Gillis where Sean told him that he had killed the 8 women. So he was compelled to testify in the trial against them, which he did. But I don't know. They had so much evidence. to me, it sounded like it was a slam dunk.
Yeah, you would think, for sure.
Now, the next year, in early 2009, Gillis pleaded guilty to first-degree murder of Marilyn Nevels, and he received another life sentence. And later on that year, the Louisiana Supreme Court, they refused to hear his appeal on this issue of his confession in his murder trial of Joyce Williams. So it went all the way up to the Louisiana Supreme Court, but they wouldn't hear it. Now, we talked about him being charged with 7 of the 8 murders, which he was, but he was only tried and convicted on 3.
They didn't need to try him on all of them.
Well, he's already got, what, 3 life sentences?
Yeah. I mean, so why go through all the expense? I mean, you reach out to the families, and I think most families would understand if you explained it the right way to them, you know, that he's never going to get out. He's never going to be paroled.
Yeah, I mean, one of his life sentences was life with no parole. So, but then you add 2 other life sentences on top of that. He's never getting out. He's currently serving out his time at the Louisiana State Penitentiary. But we talked about other serial killers, right? In 2011, Jeffrey Lee Guillory, who was another serial killer who operated in the same area at the same time that Gillis and Lee did, he was on trial. His defense team asserted that it was Sean Gillis that was responsible for a number of the murders for which Guillory had been charged. But Gibbs, I guess that's going to happen, right? We kind of touched on it earlier. When you have that number of serial killers operating in the same space at the same time, I mean, I read one article that said in the past 20 years, 70 people in and around Baton Rouge have been killed by what they believe to be 4 or 5 different serial killers.
Man, that's a lot.
It really is.
People think Ohio is bad.
And I'm sure there's more. I'm sure the number is probably even higher.
Yeah.
That they just don't even really know about.
Wow.
So Gibbs, we talked a little bit about Terry Lemoyne and, you know, her shock at the news that her boyfriend was a serial killer. But I read that she still lives in that same house where some very gruesome stuff took place. And she still owns Sean's car that was used to transport a number of his victims' bodies.
Yeah. Well, you know, somebody out there would buy that car.
You mean for the memorabilia factor, probably.
Yeah.
There are some collectors that would buy it. I read that and I thought, you know, I think I would be looking to move on.
Yeah, I'd be out of the house. I'd want to.
I wouldn't be living in the place where I know my boyfriend murdered multiple people or brought their bodies back to after they were dead and showered with them.
Yeah.
Had sex with them, cut them up.
Yeah, I'd be out.
Like a casino dealer.
Yeah, but maybe she can't even sell the house.
Well, that's true, but...
But then again, you know, I'm saying there's people that like that stuff. But they'd buy anything. It and they'd want to sleep there and hang out there.
But the one thing that Terry has said in interviews is never think you know everything about anybody. Never.
Well, it could be a true statement. You know?
I think it's a very true statement, actually.
You're going to know what they want you to know or what they want you to perceive to know.
Right.
But will you ever know everything?
Because I know for a fact I don't know everything about you. And if I did, it would probably...
Yeah, you just scratched the surface.
Melt me down into a ball in the corner, weeping.
You just scratched the surface. That's about it.
But I think even husband and wives, as close as they think they are, they don't know everything.
Probably not. I don't think...
Most
husband, wife, wives. Boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever. I don't know if they really know everything they think they know.
So, Gibbs, I want to wrap this episode up talking about the victims and their families, right? A lot of the cases that we profile involve victims that were sex workers or drug users. These are victims that authorities often refer to as leading a high-risk lifestyle. And there were victims that, you know, had some of these same traits in this case. And you and I have said many times that no matter what, right, these are still people that were victims of violent crimes, regardless of what type of things you know, they were doing, what was going on in their lives. In the research, I found some articles about these women and their families. I touched on the fact that many had children, and you know, some of these children spoke out after their deaths about what great mothers they were, especially when they were younger, before they got, you know, maybe hooked on drugs or they got into the sex industry, sex work. Some of these children found out those aspects of their mothers only after their deaths, when the newspapers and television started reporting on it. Some of them didn't know, right, what their mothers had been doing.
Right.
Donna Johnston's children, now they were aware of her drug use, and they said over time she began fading in and out of their lives, but they loved her and they tried time after time to get her help.
Yeah, I think it's tough, you know, when people have an addiction and you try to, as their loved ones, you want to help them, but sometimes you might push them away because you're overly helping. And I think that, you know, they feel like they're let you down, disappointed you, so then they turn their back on you. Well, and you just keep chasing the circle, you know?
Yeah, and I think when people don't want help,
you can't help them.
It's tough.
Yeah.
And then there were stories from some of the kids about running after their moms and saying, you know, mom, don't leave. Don't go buy drugs.
I mean, unfortunately, it's a big thing in our country, you know, addiction.
No,
it's probably everywhere.
It's horrible. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just.
And it seems to be getting worse.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, these street drugs are so easily available and pretty inexpensive. So it's not what you would typically see, you know, the typical clientele of a drug dealer today is your coworker and your neighbor.
Or sadly, your high school student.
Or your high school student, or your wife or husband.
Yeah,
you know?
It can be.
Yeah.
Now, some of the children of these women, they were extremely upset about the photos used in newspapers and on the television screen depicting their mothers. You know, for many, that was not the person they knew. And they made sure that the outlets had other photos of their mothers that showed them during, you know, happier parts of their lives. Probably most importantly, I think they just wanted people to be aware that their loved ones were murdered and that it was just as important as any other murder.
Yeah.
So no, I wanted to end on that because it's something that we don't always talk about. We don't always think about. I mean, the children.
Yeah.
And some of these women had 4 and 5 children that they left behind.
Yeah.
And it's not just the fact that they lost their mother. I mean, you hear them talking about it. It's the fact of how the media portrayed their mothers. Yeah. They were upset about that, too.
And we hate that, right? I mean, because we know these are people,
yeah,
right? We said they're a mother, sister, daughter, somebody, and they deserve the respect, you know? You can't harp on what was going on in their life at the time.
Yeah, I mean, you may not agree with the lifestyle choices they made.
We all make bad decisions. Some people just don't recover from those decisions.
Again, the bottom line is they didn't deserve to be murdered.
Nobody deserves to be murdered.
But that's it. That is the case of Sean Vincent Gillis. He wasn't a guy that I was that familiar with, Gibbs, before I started, you know, diving into the research. And he's as bad as they come.
He ranks up there, man. I am surprised that he is as not as known, lesser known than some of the other ones we've done.
Yeah.
I'm really shocked. But again, now
we keep asking that question, right? What is it that moves the needle for a killer to be infamous or, you know, extremely well known? And there's a bunch of different factors. Yeah. We've talked about some of them.
Yeah, I mean, he's no Scott Peterson, so he's not going to grab that audience.
Well, we'll post pictures like we always do. This guy's not even Drew Peterson. Okay. he's pretty rough looking.
He's like the Night Stalker's worst side.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, again, a lot of women like Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez,
I know,
attractive. I don't get it.
There's a group of them that did.
I think he looks like a skeleton with big hair, but
man, some women love that stuff, man.
Yeah.
You know what? There's somebody out there for everybody.
For everyone. All right, Gibbs, we got some voicemails. You want to dive into those?
Yeah, let's hear them.
Hey, Mike and Gibby. My name is Danielle Daverona, and I just wanted to let you know how much I absolutely love all of your podcasts. I've listened all the way through True Crime All the Time, and I'm working my way through True Crime All the Time Unsolved. However, I was re-listening to another case on True Crime All the Time, and you guys wondered out loud why somebody might freeze body parts, and I was just going to let you know, I've been listening to a lot of different podcasts, and this has been addressed before. A lot of times people will freeze body parts to disguise time of death, so it can be years later and people won't know, because of the way that the freezer impacts or impedes the way that a body decomposes. So I just kind of wanted to drop that knowledge on you guys and say thank you so much for all you do. Hope you're having a great day and keep your own time ticking. Bye.
All right.
Dropping some knowledge.
Thanks for that voicemail. I'm not sure what episode that was, Gibbs, but I mean, that's something that I've known for a long time. I watched Dexter. I watched CSI. Now, the one thing I do remember, I think we were talking about Jerry Brudos. He kept a foot in his freezer. And I think I remember us talking about why in the world would he keep it there where when his wife might walk down looking for a pound of hamburger or something like that. Which I don't remember.
Grab a foot.
Yeah, and grab a foot. But maybe we did talk about that. But that's something that, you know, I've known for a long time that does mask, can mask the time of death.
Hey, excuse me. I just wanted to know, you are my favorite, no bullshit, but my other podcast that I listen to, one of them is Canadian True Crime. She's really lovely. She mentioned a Chicago, which is where I'm from, the area, 2019 July 13th True Crime like convention. And I just wanted to know if you guys are going, if you are thinking about it. And it's $75 a ticket, and if you guys are going and she's going, I'm definitely going to go. But I just wanted to get an idea, or if you hadn't heard of it, you probably have because you guys are in the business, but you are in the loop more than I am. I just wanted to mention it just to compare it and get more people to go to it. Of course, your fans in the area will, of course, travel to it, I'm sure. All right, just wanted to mention it, guys.
All right, love that voicemail. We also love Christy, a Canadian true crime.
We do.
So we haven't announced it just because it's so far away, but it's a great time to. We are going to be there. We'll be in Chicago.
Chicago.
For this podcast convention. So if anybody's planning ahead and they want to hang out with us.
Sing Frank's song.
Frank's song.
Frank's.
Frank's.
Sinatra.
What song's that?
Chicago Is.
Chicago Is what?
My kind of town.
Is that how the song goes?
Probably not.
I thought he always sang about New York.
He does that too. He sings Chicago.
Does he?
Yeah.
He sings about all the major cities.
Yeah. Yeah. Dayton is.
He covers all of town.
Yeah. Everywhere he goes.
He covers all his fans.
So, hey, we'll be there. Chicago.
Yeah. Yep. We are on. If you go out to the website, you'll see our logo. We're signed up.
Read up some Chicago dogs.
Oh, maybe some deep dish. I don't know.
Maybe. Good to see.
Hey, Mike and Gibby. This is Rain from Spokane, Washington, which I have officially figured out. I hear a lot through your podcast. I have binged pretty much every show, but I'm just listening to the Chevy Kehoe, and my mom a few years ago told me about some sketchy things that she was doing when she first had me, and it turns out we actually lived in the Shadow Motel while that was being staked out. So I was probably about 1 year old at the time, but I just thought that was kind of crazy. But just to let you know, you did say in the podcast, if you go there for your vacation, it was actually knocked down quite a few years ago. And the lot is actually completely vacant, but they still have the Shadow Motel sign up. Kind of creepy. Anyway, just wanted to call and say hello. My first time calling, and keep your own tight ticket. Have a great day.
All right. That was awesome, Gibbs. You know how much I love the stories about the connections to the cases that we talk about.
Yeah.
Brushes with these killers or, you know, 6 degrees of separation, whatever it is. I love those type of stories.
Yeah, absolutely. I do too.
All right, Gibbs, we got mailbag. We only got one, so it will go quick. Katie Wilson sent me a chip from El Cajon.
El Cajon.
Not El Cajones, which I'm assuming you're
was going to
thinking of, but El Cajon, California. And she actually sent some pictures with it of like the Hell's Angel hangout. And I guess it's like the only place on this block that is pristine. Like all the other buildings are tagged or, you know, have graffiti or whatever, but nobody will touch the Hell's Angels headquarters or building or whatever it is. It's like perfectly white, perfectly pristine.
Really?
Yeah. There's also a big sign that says, I think graffiti can be hazardous to your health or something like that. And it was signed like that Hell's Angels chapter. I got a kick out of it. All right, Gibbs, you ready to wrap it up?
Ready to wrap it up.
All right. That is it for another episode of True Crime All the Time. So for Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking.
Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.